Throughout this year, we have been studying the letter to the Hebrews. This letter, it was written to ethnic Jews who had converted to Jesus and were suffering severely for it. When the letter was written, many of them were thinking, wouldn't life be so much easier if we just stopped following Jesus? If we just returned to the religion that we grew up with, the Christless Judaism? It's still religion. It's still moral. And life would sure be a whole lot easier if we turned our backs on Jesus. And the dominant burden of the author in this letter is to say, persevere, endure. And he encouraged their endurance by pointing them to the supreme glory of Jesus. If you turn away from Jesus, you turn away from everything. Eternal life, eternal rest, eternal glory, eternal experience of the presence of God. You lose it all if you turn away from Jesus. Today we arrive at the heart of the book, chapter 7, in which the author describes Jesus as the ultimate priest or the ultimate mediator who can bring humans into a permanent relationship with God. I'm going to read Hebrews 7, but I invite you to keep one hand here, and we're going to very quickly survey three other passages. We're going to begin in Genesis 14, and then I'll call out the other two passages, but really, reading these three passages or understanding them is absolutely critical to understanding Hebrews 7. The first of four passages we're going to read is Genesis 14. Genesis 14 takes place around 2000 BC. It's an event in the life of Abram. Abram is the man whom God had promised to bless, and God had said, through you, Abram, through your offspring, I'm going to bless all peoples, all nations on earth. I'm going to bless the world through Abram. So Abram is a significant guy in terms of the plan of God. Abram is a progenitor, an ancestor of Jesus, and it would be through Abram's offspring, Jesus, that God would bless the whole world. This is 2,000 years before Jesus. Verses 1 through 9 of Genesis 14 explain how there was a battle in the Middle East between four allied kings and five allied kings. Verse 12, Genesis 14, 12 explains that the four kings, the League of Four Kings, won. And they took people from the five cities of the other kings, and they took plunder, and they started running back to their area with it. Among those POWs was Abram's nephew Lot. Verse 14, Genesis 14, 14, describes that Abram sent 318 men from his property. Abram must have been a very wealthy business owner. He had 300 security guards, and he sent them out, and those 318 men overtook the soldiers of the four league cities, and they recovered Lot, and they recovered the rest of the people. They recovered all the plunder, and they brought them back to Abram. Now read verse 18 with me. Abram has the plunder and people from five cities. It says, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of the Most High God. He blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abram gave this priest, Melchizedek, a tenth of everything he had just recovered. Abram gave him 10% of the plunder. And then we find out in the next few verses that he gave the other 90% back to the four kings, or the five kings who had lost. So Abram kept none of it, but he gave a tenth of it to this priest, Melchizedek. What we read in those three verses, Genesis 14, verses 18, 19, and 20, is all we know about Melchizedek in the Bible. But every detail is significant, as the next passage we read shows. The next passage now, again, keeping a hand in Hebrews 7, flip to Psalm 110. We looked at this a little bit last week. Psalm 110. We're going to read just the first four verses. 1,000 years after Abram met Melchizedek, David wrote Psalm 110. David, as you know from Psalm 1, was someone who meditated in the law of the Lord day and night, which means he often read Genesis 14. I guess that David actually penned Psalm 110 soon after he was studying Genesis 14. It's in Psalm 110 that David basically says, God's chosen king for earth, the Christ or the Messiah, God's chosen king for earth would be Abram's descendant and David's descendant, and he would be a king priest exactly like Melchizedek. Let's read the first four verses. A Psalm of David. The Lord says to my Lord, that is David's Lord, David's authority, the one who would reign on earth, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments. From the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. In other words, this king that I've chosen will be mighty. And then God says it explicitly. The Lord has sworn he will not change his mind. You, David's descendant and David's Lord, are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. God's chosen king for planet Earth will be a priest after Melchizedek's order. That's what David wrote, 1000 BC. David clearly realized that his descendant, the Messiah, who would reign forever as king on earth, would be also an eternal priest. He would be forever ruling in righteousness, and he'd forever make peace between sinners and God. David realized, in other words, that if there was going to be an eternal king and an eternal priest, he would not be from the tribe of Levi. He had to be, of course, David knew, from the tribe of Judah, which meant he had to be a priest of a completely different kind than the Jews knew throughout their history. Let's now flip to the third passage, Matthew chapter 22. Matthew 22. This is now 1,000 years after David. So we've seen 2,000 BC, Abram's life, 1,000 BC, David's life, and now in the life of Christ, around 30 AD. What takes place here takes place very soon before the cross, takes place shortly before the crucifixion. Jesus' enemies had publicly confronted him with controversial questions. They tried to trip him up in public. Kind of sounds like modern media press conferences of every kind. They asked him about taxes. They asked him about theology. They asked him about the law. And Matthew records in chapter 22 the profound answers he gave that silenced them. And then Jesus had a question for them, and his question centered around Psalm 110. This is Matthew 22, verse 41. Now, while the Pharisees, these would be Jesus' enemies, legal scholars who were trying to expose him as a fraud, while they were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question about the Old Testament. He asked, "What do you think about the Messiah? Whose son is he?" They said, "He's a descendant of David." He said to them, "How is it then that David in the Spirit calls him Lord?" And here Jesus quotes Psalm 110:1, saying, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet." Jesus reasons, verse 45, "If then David calls him Lord, how is he his descendant, his son?" No one was able to answer Jesus another word, nor from that day did anyone dare ask him any more questions. Jesus silenced them with his wisdom. Based on Psalm 110, Jesus teaches that the Messiah is both David's descendant, but also David's Lord. In other words, he would be the individual on earth to whom every human would owe total allegiance. This third passage clearly reveals that Jesus understood that Psalm 110 was all about him, that he was going to be not only earth's eternal king, but earth's eternal priest. Now, Hebrews 7. Flip to Hebrews 7. You have to understand those three passages before you can understand the point the author is making in Hebrews 7. About 30 years after Jesus' death, resurrection, and ascension, the writer to the Hebrews, these persecuted Jews who've become followers of Jesus, he preaches a sermon based on Psalm 110 and Genesis 14. He preaches the sermon that Jesus is the ultimate mediator, so don't turn your back on Jesus. Keep following him no matter how hard it is. The thing he does, I'm actually breaking this chapter down into four sections, but the thing he does in verses 1 through 3 is he urges the people to consider the bits of information we know about Melchizedek. So he's preaching a sermon. What does it mean that Jesus is the ultimate mediator, the ultimate individual who can reconcile sinners with God and bring them into the presence of God? He says to understand what it means that Jesus is after the order of Melchizedek, we have to go back and read as much as we can about Melchizedek. And that's what he does in verses 1 through 3. Verse 1, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings, and he blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He's first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness, Melchizedek. Melchizedek, to put it together. Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Then he's also, the writer says, king of Salem, or Shalom, king of peace. And in the text of Genesis 14, he doesn't have any genealogy listed. No mother, no father. Doesn't list when he had a birth date or when he died. And in these ways, he resembles the Son of God. He continues as a priest forever. So in verses 1 through 3, this first section, the writer considers Melchizedek's name, his place of origin, his background, and he shows that someone like Melchizedek must be superior to any priest or king that any Jew had ever known. His point is that Jesus resembles Melchizedek. Jesus is a perfectly righteous, peacemaking, eternal king and priest. That is someone like no Jew had ever encountered. In the second section, the writer says, consider the fact that Abraham paid him tithes. That's what verses 4 through 10 is about. He's explaining the fact that Abram paid Melchizedek tithes. Verse 4. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth, a tithe of his spoils. And those descendants of Levi who receive the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, even though these are descended from Abraham. His point is that all throughout the Old Testament, under the Levitical priestly system, under the law of Moses, the priests, by law, extracted tithes from their brothers. But with Melchizedek, it's different. Verse 6. But this man, Melchizedek, who doesn't have his descent from them, received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It's beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In other words, Melchizedek is greater than Abraham because Melchizedek is blessing Abraham. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it's testified that he lives. This is a man of a different kind. This is God become man, is going to be his point. One might even say that Levi himself, who received tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Now, Levi is the third son of Jacob, who was Abraham's grandson. So Levi is Abraham's great-grandson. That's the point he's making, that if Melchizedek is greater than Abraham, Melchizedek is greater than Levi and all the priests that came eventually in Israel's history from Levi. So the writer explains here in the second section, verses 4 through 10, that Melchizedek didn't force Abraham to give him a tithe. Instead, Abraham gave it voluntarily. It wasn't legally extracted. It was a voluntary gift. and then Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek. Both of those observations prove that Jesus, being a priest like Melchizedek, as Psalm 110 says, that's the passage he's explaining, Jesus being a priest like Melchizedek is superior to Abraham and every Levitical priest. And then the author is going to escalate it even further. The third section is verses 11 to 19. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron, who was a son of Levi? For when there's a change in priesthood, like from Levitical priest to Melchizedekan priest, there is also necessarily a change in law as well. It's like you're setting aside the whole law of Moses, because that priesthood is inadequate. For the one of whom these things are spoken belong to another tribe, from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it's evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, and in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. So this must be greater than the law. He says, verse 15, this becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest, not on the basis of a Mosaic legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. Jesus is a priest, the eternal priest, because he himself has the power of life within him. It's inherent. It's not simply bestowed on him. It's inherent within him because Jesus is life. Verse 17, for it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after Melchizedek's order. On the one hand, a former commandment, like all the Levitical priesthood set up by Moses, it's all set aside because it's weak and useless, for the law didn't have the ability to make people's hearts perfect. But on the other hand, we're introduced to a better hope through which we draw near to God. This is a priest who can change us and who can actually bring us into the presence of God forever. The author's point here in this third section, verses 11 through 19, is massive. He reasons, if Psalm 110 says that earth's king is going to be a Melchizedekan priest, then there must be something inadequate with the Levitical priests, which means there must be something inadequate with the entire law of Moses. Of course, the problem with the law of Moses is it can't actually forgive sinners once and for all. It can just point ahead to Jesus, who can forgive sins. It can picture the coming reality. But his point is that Jesus is a priest of an order whose power has never been seen on earth. He's not authorized by Moses. He's authorized by the fact that he is life indestructible. Jesus is superior to the entire law of Moses. He's the one to whom the whole Old Testament has been pointing. So again, you can hear the author saying, don't go back to Judaism without Jesus. Keep following Jesus no matter how hard it is. His fourth section, he ends by saying, consider that Jesus was established a priest like this by God's oath. Consider God's oath, verses 20 through 28. And it was not without an oath. You may remember that this was the point that the author was driving at. We pointed it out last week at the end of chapter 6, saying when God wants you to be doubly certain of something, he speaks on our level. He uses an oath. Verse 20, it was not without an oath. For those who formerly became priests, that is, all the Levites throughout Israel's history, they were made such without an oath. But this one was made a priest with an oath by the one who said to him in Psalm 110, the Lord has sworn, that's an oath, he will not change his mind, you're a priest forever. The writer says, verse 22, this clearly makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. And then he moves toward his climax, comparing Jesus with all other priests in Old Testament history. He says, the former priests were many in number, because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But Jesus holds his priesthood permanently because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost, or he is able to save completely and forever those who draw near to God through him, since Jesus always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners. That means he's in a totally different category. He's sinless. He's exalted now above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered himself up on the cross. Verse 28, for the law appoints men in their sinful weakness as high priests, but the word of the Lord's oath in Psalm 110, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made priest forever. So the author has compared Jesus with all other priests in Old Testament history, and he says there were many Levitical priests. There's one Jesus, only one. He said, they all died. He's alive. They were all sinners and needed someone to reconcile them with God. He's sinless and can offer himself up to reconcile you with God. They were mere humans. Jesus is God's son, God become man. He can actually mediate between humans and God. The point he ends on is that because of God's oath, the Lord has sworn, Jesus is my king, priest forever. You can be doubly certain that Jesus is the only mediator you need between yourself and God, now and forever. That's the point the author's been driving at. Now, you might look at me with like a whitewash right now, be like, you lost me the first time you said the name Melchizedek. I think often because of the name Melchizedek, it's so foreign, it seems so weird. People think that what the writer is communicating in Hebrews 7 is complex. And I hope I've shown you this morning that if you know Genesis 14, you know Psalm 110, you know Matthew 22, couple verses here, there. You know how they fit into history. You know who's talking, who's saying what from the Lord. It's pretty simple. The main point the writer makes is actually in Hebrews 8:1, and it is very simple, and it is profound. The writer has been preaching for a chapter, a sermon based on Psalm 110. And he says, okay, here's my main point. Hebrews 8:1. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest. He's right now in the presence of God. He's saying, this is your high priest, Christian, suffering Christian. He stands there forever to plead for you. He can save you now and forever. You have this kind of high priest. That's his point. It's not complex. It's not academic. It's immensely practical. I end with two questions. First question is for those who are not followers of Jesus. How do you imagine that you're going to stand before God, your creator? When you stand to give an account to the God who made you and who has given you every breath, every minute of every day of your life, you, like me, have lived mostly for self. I'm not saying that we're as bad as we could be, but we are made by God to first and foremost love God with everything we are, to commit ourselves to God. And that's not the way we're naturally bent, is it? And then, as Jesus said in Matthew 22, our second primary obligation is very similar. It's we are to always put others ahead of ourselves. Does that come naturally for you? Doesn't come naturally for me. How are naturally, inwardly bent, selfishly bent people like us going to stand before the God who made us to live for him and others? How are we going to stand? How are you going to stand? This whole chapter is about our mediator. So let me tell you how you will not stand before God. When you stand before the holy God as your king and judge, what's going to be your plea when he says, "Why should I from this point on have anything to do with a selfish person like you?" What will be your plea? If your plea is something like this, "I tried to be good. I went to church. I was religious. I wasn't all bad." Do you see each of those answers, which is extremely common throughout religion in the world, not to mention religion and even Christianity, sadly, in America? Be a good person. Think of yourself as a generally good person. Do you know that that won't fly one bit? Because when you stand in God's presence and give an account, everything I just said is, "Look at me. I'm not that bad. I've been good. Look at what I've done. Look at me." The only answer that's going to fly in God's presence is, "Jesus, he's my plea." In the presence of God, the only way anyone's going to stand is if you have a priest, a mediator, who's there to plead for you, saying, "He's one of mine. I died for him. I choose to forgive him of all of his sins. I died in her place. Father, she's mine." The only plea that will stand in the presence of God is Jesus pointing away from yourself to the mediator, the high priest. I urge you to commit your life to Jesus. Turn from your self-righteousness, thinking that you might be good enough to stand in God's presence, and instead commit yourself to earth's ultimate superior king and priest. If you have him, you have more than enough. My question for believers is this: what kind of encouragement really helps you to endure? When I step back from this passage, there's something that never ceases to amaze me. Think about it like this. If you have a friend in prison who's there in prison for following Jesus, and you have an opportunity to write them 10 letters of encouragement while they're in prison for following Jesus, how many of you in here in one of those letters would even mention Melchizedek? Why not? Would it ever occur to you to say, "Jesus is your Melchizedekan priest. Grab hold of it and don't let it go. I'm totally serious. This is the truth that Christians need to endure." What encourages God's people at our lowest times is the truth of Hebrews 8:1. You have this kind of priest. He's totally righteous. He forever lives to make peace between you and God. I think too often the kind of encouragement we're looking for is superficial, and may I say, it may even be selfish. We want other Christians to stroke our ego. "You'll get through this. You're strong." No, don't think of yourself as weak. You can do this. The kind of encouragement that the writer gives here is very different. Look at Jesus. He's your mediator. Don't let go of Jesus. We often think that we need someone in our low times to personally stroke our ego, when we need someone to point us personally to the eternal glory of Jesus. If the fact that Jesus is a priest after Melchizedek's order does little to encourage you, then believer, stop today and sink your roots deep down into this chapter this week until you say, "This is my priest. I have this kind of priest." Believer, don't look for inspirational messages that just pat you on the back to prepare yourself for hard trials that certainly lay ahead. Some of you are experiencing right now. You need solid, Christ-centered truth. And when you and I sink our hearts into these realities that God has spoken over thousands of years, all to prove that Jesus is the one and only King and Priest who has indestructible life, who can truly bring us into God's presence forever. When you sink your roots deep into that, you won't let go of Jesus. You'll endure with eyes fixed on Jesus. That's the kind of truth we all need this week to endure.